Maybe it's not mine. I chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make to heaven in the middle of it. Rest make to heaven in the middle. We are. Rest make to heaven in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a lot going on in this country, and some good and some bad. My gosh, there's an attack that was launched by the Yemen Houthis. They're taking, responsibility for the attack. There were 10 drones that attacked a couple of oil sites in Saudi Arabia. And we're going to play some reports right now about that.
Hi, Eric. So Saudi authorities have not yet given any official figures for the level of disruption to its oil production. But already we're seeing the impact of these strikes, and it is anticipated that there could be some significant disruption to come. Now, what we saw in these strikes was two major oil processing facilities in Saudi Arabia hit in a series of drone strikes overnight. It saw 10 drones were used in all in those strikes, causing explosions and sparking huge fires. Those fires are now under control, but it's not clear either if anyone has been injured. Saudi authorities are only releasing limited details on this. And, of course, Houthi rebels in Yemen have now claimed responsibility for these attacks. It is not the first time they have attacked Saudi Arabia, but it's certainly the most brazen. A spokesman for the rebels says these attacks will continue unless the Saudi government ceases its military campaign in Yemen. Now, the kingdom has been battling Houthi rebels in Yemen since March 2015, and this latest escalation does not bode well for a peaceful settlement to that conflict. Now, Houthis have launched rockets across the border towards Saudi Arabia before, but this is the first time they have carried out such a sophisticated attack. So this could be a game changer when it comes to relations between Saudi Arabia and the Houthi rebels. And of course, as you mentioned, these Houthi rebels, they are Iranian-backed, and this is effectively a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And certainly this does not help bring peace to the region. Eric?
Yeah, it seems Iran's brazenness knows no bound. Kitty Logan live in London for us. Thank you, Kitty. We'll have more news in just a moment.
These reports are very, very dangerous. I mean, they're very, very ominous reports. What's happened, just to give you a little background here, what's happened since May, I think one of the first problems that we had was back, in May. Four foreign oil tankers were attacked May 12th. What followed after that was an attack on tankers from Japan and Norway on June 13th. Let's go back here. I did miss a date here. Okay. Let's go back and let me correct that. May 12th, four foreign oil tankers were attacked. Okay. After that, on June 13th, we had an attack on tankers that were Japanese and Norway flagged into the Gulf of Oman and the wind. Now, what happened next was on June 19th, Iran shoots down a U.S. drone over the Strait of Hormuz. Okay. After that, we have July 10th, British Heritage tanker harassed by the Revolutionary Guards. July 20th, British Stena Imperial oil tanker seized and diverted into Iranian waters. We have August 20th, there were Iranian-backed Houthi rebels shoot down two U.S. drones over Damar Governorate in Yemen. And now we have this attack on two facilities in Saudi Arabia by the Houthis. So, I mean, this is ominous. This is very dangerous. We're edging closer and closer to a major regional conflict. The Iranians, we still have sanctions on the Iranians. They're pushing back. They first went in with the oil tankers and the Gulf of Oman and within the Persian Gulf and then the Strait of Hormuz. Then we went back and stopped one of their tankers at the Gibraltar, port of Gibraltar. They've come back now with the Houthis as their surrogate, and they're attacking Saudi oil fields, which are major attacks, and their production is going to be very, very greatly reduced. And this is going to put the oil price of oil up. Zero Hedge is reporting in their web page that even the Wall Street Journal is being reported on the Zero Hedge page. They're hinting, the Wall Street Journal is hinting, how much of the oil is set to soar when trading opens late on Sunday. So the oil market's going to be opening on Monday, but late on Sunday, and then that's when they proceed from the Pacific onward into Europe, and they close in America. And Saudi Arabia is shutting down about half of its oil output after apparently coordinated drone attacks with 10 drones hit the oil production. And the oil production shutdown is a loss of about 5 million barrels a day. And it's about 5% of the world's daily production of crude oil. The kingdom produces 9.8 million barrels a day. Aramco is assuring the Saudis that it can restore it. These are Aramco production facilities, is assuring that it can restore output quickly, but in case it can't, the world is looking at a production shortfall of as much as 150 million barrels monthly, which all else equal could send oil soaring into the triple digits. That's what some of the procrastinators are saying now. So we don't know for sure exactly what that's going to end up being. So, you know, there you got it. Now, let's monitor this over this weekend, and there'll be reports, I'm sure, on Fox and other BBC news outlets to see if there's a conflagration or a step up or, between nations in that area. Our next bit of news is coming up next. It will be about the debate that occurred in Houston this last Thursday night, and it was a very raucous event. And here's the report coming out today from Paul Chagot, and we've got three Wall Street Journal reporters expressing their views. So here we go with Paul Chagot and the Journal.
Welcome to the Journal editorial report. I'm Paul Chagot. A showdown in Texas this week as 10 of the Democratic presidential candidates took to the stage in Houston in the first debate pitting Joe Biden against both of his closest rivals, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. The issue of health care was front and center Thursday night as the candidates squared off over their plans and how to pay for them.
How are we going to pay for it? I want to hear tonight how that's happened. Thus far, my distinguished friend, the senator on my left, has not indicated how she pays for it. And the senator has, in fact, come forward and said how he's going to pay for it, but it gets him about halfway there.
Every study done shows that Medicare for All is the most cost-effective approach to providing health care to every man, woman, and child in this country. I, who wrote the damn bill, if I may say so, intend to eliminate all out-of-pocket expenses.
And while Bernie wrote the bill, I read the bill. And on page 8, of the bill, it says that we will no longer have private insurance as we know it. I don't think that's a bold idea. I think it's a bad idea.
Let's bring in Wall Street Journal columnist Kim Strasso, editorial board member Kyle Peterson, and assistant editorial page editor James Freeman. So, James, who do you think got the better of that very important healthcare exchange?
Yeah, I think Klobuchar and Biden raised the right questions for which Sanders and Warren don't have an answer. This plan, as Senator Klobuchar pointed out, is going to get rid of private insurance in America. It's also going to get rid of most of the other insurance, the government insurance too, and replace it with the new Bernie Care.
That means Medicare. That
right,
means
traditional
Obamacare,
Medicare that goes away.
Right.
They call it Medicare for All, but traditional Medicare goes away. Bernie Care, Warren Care replaces it. And then obviously Joe Biden raising the right question about the cost of this, over $30 trillion over a decade. Most of these plans don't include the funding part. If you taxed people in that top 1% at 100%, took every dollar they make every year, it still wouldn't pay for it.
Let's go to, we have a tape, a shot here of Elizabeth Warren trying answering a question about how she would pay for it.
Direct question. You said middle class families are going to pay less, but will middle class taxes go up to pay for the program?
Look, what families have to deal with is cost. Total cost. That's what they have to deal with. And understand, families are paying for their health care today. Families pay every time an insurance company says, sorry, you can't see that specialist. Every time an insurance company says, sorry, that doctor is out of network. Sorry, we are not covering that prescription.
Kim, that didn't sound like a direct answer to me.
Yeah, I was going to say that was Elizabeth Warren not answering the question. And what's remarkable, she was asked twice by the moderator to admit that she was going to have to raise taxes on middle class earners in order to pay for this program. And she essentially did, right, by not answering the question. She kept saying, oh, total costs will go down. This is a distinction between her and Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has been honest that he would raise taxes on pretty much all Americans. I mean, he's also making the argument that costs get reduced. But it was notable here, also notable that Elizabeth Warren really doubled down on Medicare for All. She's been a bit cagey about when she'd do it, how she'd do it, but she seemed to come out this week and really stand with Bernie on that issue.
Yeah, well, then she does say, okay, I'm for Medicare for All, but she's really, really, really slippery, not just about middle-class taxes, but also this point about private insurance. And it was kind of long for a follow-up by George Stephanopoulos.
Right. My favorite part of her answer was she said that she believes in covering everybody at the lowest possible cost. And why didn't we all think of that? Why didn't we think of that earlier? But meanwhile, I mean, all of the action has been between Bernie Sanders, mostly on his very hard Medicare for All policy, which he's outspoken about, and he says we're going to raise taxes, and then Joe Biden saying, no, we can build a public option. And meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren is kind of sneaking up the middle by not answering the question and not being pushed very hard. I mean, the moderator tried to get into it a little bit, but all of the other candidates on the stage were really going after the Sanders option, not the Warren option.
So, James, Biden and Klobuchar take a position which I think is much stronger in the general election against Donald Trump. But I guess the key question is, can either of them get through the Democratic primaries where Medicare for All, essentially government-run health care, is popular?
Yeah, I think we're going to see a test. Obviously, Biden, representing a relatively more moderate tone, still leading. His lead is eroded a bit, but he's still the front runner in basically every poll. Klobuchar has been bumping along at 1 or 2%, but I think she probably gets a lift out of this because they are raising issues that even among Democrats, when you poll them, this is not a universally popular idea that we're going to eliminate your current coverage and start over.
How did you think, Kyle, Elizabeth Warren did overall? She got good reviews from a lot of people in the press. But I thought she was pretty slippery on some things. And on trade, she sounded to me exactly like Donald Trump without, that sort of the bluster.
Sure. I mean, I agree. I think she sounds slippery. I think that she has one mode really on every issue. We can't fix gun control because of corruption in Washington. We can't fix health care because corruption in Washington. It's
and
the
big
same.
Corporations.
And big corporations. It's the same shtick. But again,
can't,
I mean,
everything.
Right. But you and I have watched all these debates. And if you're somebody who's just tuning in, maybe they've not quite picked up on the repeat.
Yeah, I thought the trade discussion was interesting, and I think if Xi Jinping was watching, he probably is thinking, maybe I can't just wait out Trump if I want those tariffs to come down. When asked about this, you didn't see these candidates saying the tariffs are going away. They were talking about how they would negotiate differently, how they would use the leverage differently, but you're talking about a lot of managed trade here. And in Warren's case, it's kind of beyond Trump. It's saying, I want to use the tariffs for environmental goals as well.
Kim, anything else strike you on the issues front?
Well, look, I think what we saw was some important distinctions up there on the stage. And it was often now what we got in this dynamic was Joe Biden and Amy Klobuchar stepping aside and trying to position themselves a bit more as the centrists up there and really highlighting, I think, some of the radical positions. You saw that in addition to health care, you saw that in the gun control issue, where you had Beto O'Rourke up there promising to confiscate legal, law-abiding Americans' weapons. Amy Klobuchar saying, no, we've got to do voluntary buybacks. Joe Biden actually mentioning the Constitution, which was amazing. Those were some of the differences.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. It made an appearance, you know, the old James Madison document finally come out of the closet. All right. When we come back from Amy Klobuchar's appeal to the middle, to Julian Castro's attack on Joe Biden, the second-tier candidates sought to distinguish themselves in Thursday's debate. So did any of them have a breakout moment?
Barack Obama's vision was not to leave 10 million people uncovered. He wanted every single person in this country covered. My plan would do that. Your plan would not.
They do not have to buy in. They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago. You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
Have to buy in. If she qualifies for
Medicaid, are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Be in for it.
Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago?
Julian Castro attacking Joe Biden in Thursday night's debate as the second-tier candidates struggled to distinguish themselves from the rest of the pack. So did any of them have a breakout moment? Kyle, was that a good moment for Castro or not?
I don't think it was. I don't think he chose the right moment. I mean, there was a lot of crosstalk, a lot of things being said about healthcare. When he made that comment, you know, Joe, you forgot what you said 2 minutes ago. I had forgotten what Joe said 2 minutes ago by that point. I'm relatively sure that I'm not senile, so I don't think it quite worked the way he wanted it to.
It was also wrong. Biden had said 2 minutes ago exactly what he was saying there, which is that the poorest of the poor don't have to buy in. But it was just factually wrong from Castro.
But Kim, Cory Booker, who didn't say this during the debate, but afterwards on one of the other networks, did say, you know, look, Joe Biden's stumbling, and though his kind of the way he's having a hard time presenting, that's a legitimate issue. So this is going to come out more, I think, more explicitly from some of the candidates.
Yeah, well, it would have been braver if Cory Booker had said that up on the stage instead of afterward right. When the nation wasn't watching. But, you know, look, I think, look, right issue, this is going to come up. And I think it is probably a legitimate question. But I think Castro did it the wrong way because, as James said, he actually got his facts wrong. And he did it in an aggressive, sort of nasty way. You know, there should be a discussion about maybe about whether or not Joe Biden has got the fight in him to do this, if he's the best candidate. But it wasn't a good look. But, you know, Castro has done this in every debate. It's how he tries to distinguish himself, is to come out and say some pretty harsh things about his rivals.
You know, James mentioned in the other segment that he thought Klobuchar had a couple of good moments. I did, too. It seems to me that if anybody on the so-called moderate stage up there or the others in the race has a chance to break through, it might be her because of her standing in the Senate. She's close to Iowa. I think she is a genuine kind of centrist. I mean, she's a liberal, but she's center-left as opposed to left. But the problem she has is Biden's got to go down, it seems to me, before she can emerge.
I think that's right. I mean, one thing that may help her is she's polling at about 1%. There are some other candidates.
She made 2% in 4 polls to get in the debate.
Fair enough. I'm talking about the real clear politics average.
Okay.
But there are some other candidates that are also polling in that area. You know, Steve Bullock, the Montana governor. If as the DNC rules winnow the field, if some of those other candidates drop out, Klobuchar may be able to assemble some of those 1% and 2% into something that more formidable, even if Biden stays level.
You know, our colleague Carl Rove says that this is now down to 3-person race, basically Sanders, Biden, and Warren. Do you agree with that?
No, as long as you've got debates happening and time months before the voting starts, I think there are moments and opportunities for people to emerge. And I think Klobuchar, she's still kind of introducing herself to voters. A fair amount still don't know who she is, but when you look at polls of not who people support, but Democratic voters, what do they believe? there's a lot of evidence that they are not generally ideologically as extreme as Sanders and Warren. So I think there is room for a, as you said, a liberal, not a progressive leftist to get some votes here.
Kim, what do you think of that? Some people think it's actually down to Biden versus Warren at this stage because Bernie just, he can't break through. He's got that core there, that core support from 2016, but he's basically, he's giving the same talking points from 2016 and he's not going to build on that. What do you think?
Yeah, I certainly agree that this is a three-person race. And that's why you saw some of the antics that you saw on the stage this week is you had these second-tier candidates trying to have their moment. But the problem is you've seen this again and again in the prior debates is they have a moment, they get a slight boost, you know, for instance, Kamala Harris right. or Cory Booker, and then they fade again. And it's just because all of the attention is on those three. I do agree that if I'm looking forward, I think that this is more of a Biden-Warren race because Bernie, you just look from the beginning, he never goes up or down much in the polls. He's just got his crew. Warren has been creeping up. She's been consolidating support from other people and she has, interestingly, the backing of the kind of intelligentsia on the left as well, too,
right.
which has given her a very easy pass. She even this week, she was asked no truly hard questions other than health care up there on that stage.
Yeah, I'll bet the New York Times endorses her. I want to read something from Pete Buttigieg. If there's one thing we've learned about Afghanistan, from Afghanistan, it's that the best way not to be caught up in endless war is to avoid starting one in the first place. End quote. Do you remember how the Afghan war started? I don't remember that it was we hit our own World Trade Center. That was somebody else.
He's saying this the day after 9/11 anniversary. I mean, it's just beyond weird that I don't think he can claim he was too young to know what happened on that awful day. But muddled thinking, I guess, is the extremely polite way to put it.
Harris breakthrough at all briefly, do you think, Kyle?
No, I don't think so. I think she tried to be over the top, aggressive, trying to make a joke about President Trump can turn back to Fox News, saying that he didn't pull the trigger in El Paso, but he was tweeting the ammunition. I don't think that was a good look.
All right. When we come back, the House Judiciary Committee approves guidelines for a Trump impeachment probe, but are Democrats sending mixed messages about impeachment?
Here's this great Judiciary Committee stating what they're going to do about this impeachment, and it is getting like a fantasy world of make-believe. Here we go now.
Investigation. There's no legal difference between these terms, and I no longer care to argue about the nomenclature. But let me clear up any remaining doubt. The conduct under investigation poses a threat to our democracy. We have an obligation to respond to this threat, and we are doing so. Under the procedures outlined in this resolution, we will hold hearings that allow us to further consider the evidence against the president. At those hearings, in addition to member questioning, we will allow staff counsel to participate for 1 hour per witness, evenly divided between the majority and the minority. This will allow us to develop the record in ways that the five-minute rule does not always permit. We will also allow the president to respond to the evidence in writing and on the record. No matter how we may disagree with him, President Trump is entitled to respond to the evidence in this way. And we will treat certain sensitive evidence, such as grand jury information, as being received in executive session. Under these procedures, when we have finished these hearings and considered as much evidence as we are able to gather, we will then decide whether to refer articles of impeachment to the House floor. We have a constitutional, historical, and moral obligation to fully investigate these matters and to make that decision. Let us take the next step in that work without delay. I urge my colleagues to adopt this resolution, and I yield back. I now recognize the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, the gentleman from Georgia, Mr. Collins, for his opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate this. Welcome to everybody here who was expecting one thing and getting another. Last week, I was driving to a great event. It is the opening of football season at the University of Georgia. We're going between the hedges. The day was starting as our first home game. My wife and I are driving down the road, and she's looking at her phone. She's bored. She's looking at it as it goes forward. And she's in her Instagram account.
And she looks over at me and she shows me this picture of a person as a family member, as a close family member. She looks over and she says, and a friend who was staying with us, she said, Megan told me about filters that you can use to make your appearance look better. And I said, yeah. I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, look at this picture. This looks nothing like our family member. What did she do? And I said, well, Lisa, I don't know. I said, undoubtedly she used one of the filters. What's happened today is great. The Judiciary Committee has become a giant Instagram filter to make you appear that something's happening that's not. It's a really interesting, and I hope he'll come back at this. The difference between formal impeachment proceedings and what we're doing today is a world apart, no matter what the chairman just said. And what we're looking at here is a filter to make you believe something. It's great, though, because I love this. I've not seen this much press up at 8 o'clock in the morning in a long time. When we look at this, though, let's look at the facts. Nothing we have here is anything that could not have been handled 5 minutes before a hearing of any time that we have. The filter may make you think something's happening, but really what we have is a walk down the yellow brick road. In fact, you want to see the yellow brick road? Let's go to the whereas clauses. The Emerald City is impeachment, and my colleagues are desperate to get there. They have been desperate since last November when they won the majority, and they started this path. They walked. Look at the whereas clauses on what they're doing and how they're doing it. In fact, what's really interesting, though, is very disturbing to me is the whereas clause in the second paragraph when it admits that the Russian government interfered in the 2016 election, yet we've had no hearings and no bills brought forward in this committee that deals with that issue. Undoubtedly, we acknowledge it, like we've done a lot of things in this committee, but we don't want to solve it because we'd rather talk about it. So we continue the whereas clauses. We continue the whereas this. The yellow brick road. What's interesting is all along they thought people were coming along with them and that the public was happy with this and that other members in their own party were happy with this. But somewhere down the yellow brick road, they looked around and said, there's not all of us here. People aren't following anymore. And then we come to today, the resolve part, which is actually the real part of this resolution, which again, for all of the folks covering this, this is not anything special. In fact, let's talk about it. Number one, the chairman may designate a full committee or subcommittee hearing for the purpose of presentation of information to this committee. Oh, my goodness, you can do that anytime you wake up. The chairman could wake up this morning and say, this is what we're doing today. Why do we need a resolve clause for that? I didn't know we needed to define the chairman's authority into saying what we're going to do today. He's made it very clear for all year this is what he wants to do. The second one. If a witness is called to testify, the committee staff, here we are again, because we know it looks more impeachment-like if we have staff answering questions. I don't know what it's like on the other side of the aisle here, but staff meetings must be heck around here because I've never seen a majority bunch of members who desperately want to give away their authority to staff to do something. I've never seen this with the brand of lawyers that you have on your side of the aisle. I am amazed that you just don't ask for more member questioning and let some of these brilliant lawyers go at it because they're good. But yet, undoubtedly, I'm not sure who what's happening on that side, but this desperation to get staff to be in the spotlight to ask questions is just something that is, again, Instagram filter. Let's put it in there to look like something that it's really not. And for some lawyers, and I'm looking at one right here, Mr. Raskin, is amazing. I don't understand this one, but hey, again though, let me think. This could have been done at any hearing. At any hearing we do, the chairman just has to bring it up as a motion. It's in the rules. We don't have to be doing this as a resolution. But it looked really good over the weekend when we said we're going to start inquiries into impeachment, and we're going to put regulations in place to do that. And then it went off the track completely through the week because even their own leadership didn't know what they were doing. Then number three, now this one's a problem. It talks about executive session, how they're going to handle information, because here's a problem. They already promised in court filings that they had these procedures in place. In fact, I wrote a letter to the chairman saying, no, you really don't here, and the copy of the letter I have here, you don't have these in place. And so it's really interesting. Maybe this is a time, maybe they thought the judges would miss it. Well, right now the TV camera's on. Judges, you might want to look at this. They didn't have the procedures in place. You may have a filing saying you did, but you don't. And also, let me also say for anybody listening here, this can't be kept strictly in. This rules cannot contradict House rules. Any member of the House can see this material. Any member of the House can. The last one, this one is the most amazing. I mean, we've been building up. One, two, three, four. I am so happy that this resolution says that the President Council may respond in writing to information and testimony presented in the committee in open session after the fact. Everybody in this room, everybody in this country, everybody outside this country can do this. Anybody who has an email address, anybody who has a pen and paper can write a letter to this committee. We're now letting the president, we're telling him that he can do this? As if this president has a hard time expressing himself? I think he understands this in his counsel. And then the chairman, after consultation with me, can invite the president to review. This is, again, this shows you how, frankly, unfortunately silly we've gotten today. To actually put in number 4 resolution to say that the president and his counsel can write a letter to this committee. Have we gotten to that point yet? Really? So, look, the Instagram filter is applied. Make sure it looks good. Spruce up the parts. Make your story look good. The press is here. We've been, you know, I've wanted a long time to be able to say this. Welcome to Fantasy Island. Because we're here. It may all look good. The unfortunate part is when the screen goes down, you just see a simple procedure issue. A simple procedure issue that doesn't do with impeachment. That doesn't do with anything else. It just simply gives another press release for whatever we're doing now. So it's early. It's 8 o'clock. The popcorn's on. And as I've said, let the show begin. I yield back.
This impeachment that this Judiciary Committee is trying to create some kind of an illusion that this is a lawful way to approach an impeachment charge against the president. And I think that's what Collins was saying in his points that he went over there, that they were trying to create some kind of a legal mechanism to go after the president to make him even appear to be malleable, you know, and so forth. Well, coming up next is a clip between Alex Jones and Robert Barnes, and they're discussing the possibility of a McCabe indictment. He was a nexus of many of the wrongdoing, evidently, according to the Inspector General. And so it's getting close to possibility of him being indicted very soon. But listen to this, what they said. But also, Robert Barnes points out that McCabe had access to a lot of people. And he was really at the center of the nexus of possibly wrongdoing. So here we go now with that discussion between Alex Jones and Robert Barnes.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, there's a reason I'm always hitting refresh on Infowars.com, NewsWars.com. There's a reason I'm always hitting refresh at DrudgeReport.com. During the break, I went to DrudgeReport.com, and what did I see right there? LinkedIn Red. Let's put it up on screen, ladies and gentlemen. I'm glad we've got a criminal lawyer, we've got a defense lawyer, we've got a First Amendment lawyer, we've got a litigation lawyer. We've got it all here. There it is, red linked on the left-hand side of DrudgeReport.com. U.S. attorney recommends proceeding with charges against Andrew McCabe as DOJ rejects last-ditch appeal. I told you a year ago that I was told that in Maryland and Virginia, grand juries were open on him. And this isn't some nebulous stuff. This was from high-level sources. And that the word is they had issued sealed indictments, real ones. Now, Barnes knows more how this works than I do. I mean, he's done a lot of famous criminal cases. And he was reading over the Fox News. He says they don't understand exactly what was just said, but in the meat of it, they are correct. And so to go over this, we have him here to break it down. We'll do a little bit in the next hour. Then Matt Brackett's coming up to get to all the other stuff I said I would. But this is breaking down. I think you agree with me. We need to hit this now. I just kind of lost my breath there. Because this means, I mean, Trump's on the rampage. The fact that they're doing this means the House of Cards is coming down, man. This is really good news. And I told you the word is from people when I was in D.C. 3 months ago. I talked to 3 people that were in face-to-face meetings with Trump. And he said, no, they're going after him. U.S. Attorney Jesse Liu has recommended moving forward with charges against Andrew McCabe. Fox News has learned. As the Justice Department rejects a last-ditch appeal, that's not literally a legal appeal through courts, it means through the system, from the former top FBI official. McCabe, the former deputy and acting director of the FBI, appealed the decision of the U.S. attorney from Washington all the way up to Jeffrey Rosen. And that was just internal. The deputy attorney general, but
He rejected the request, according to a person familiar with the situation. That's when he started putting out little messages apologizing to his boss over there, the 7'8" creature, Comey. The potential charges relate to DOJ Inspector General findings against him. And, of course, we've seen the Texas congressman that Trump recommended to be the head of national intelligence, but the left freaked out, saying the word is he's got to be indicted and that he is going to be indicted. That was over the weekend. Sources close to McCabe legal team said they received an email from the Department of Justice, which the department rejected your appeal, the United States Attorney General's decision in the matter. Now, you're here to decipher. This isn't a court, what type of appeal this really is, and what you read here in the tea leaves. But this, am I right so far? This shows the dam's breaking.
Oh, no doubt about it. The inside story on this is fascinating. So all of this started, Andrew McCabe was the actual director of the FBI. So he'll be the first FBI director I know of to ever be criminally prosecuted in our history.
Wow.
Even though most of them, frankly, could have been for various things they did while they were there.
So this is big. This is watershed.
Massive, massive.
Because they tried to take down an elected president. Sorry, you're not bigger than that.
This is one of the most powerful members of the deep state finally seeing potential consequences for his conduct.
Will this have Hillary and bricks?
Maybe. I mean, Hillary feels so immune from the process. Though Hillary was deeply embedded with this. His potential information, he has said before that he will rat anybody and everybody out. He's made that clear, that he'll rat Comey out, he'll rat anyone else out. Remember,
that's why CNN hired him as hush money.
Exactly. Remember, McCabe is the guy who raised almost $700,000 overnight for his legal defense.
Are we going to see, we're not making a threat, we wanted to live a long time in prison. Are we going to see Epstein, McCabe, we're going to see him have a canoeing accident?
Well, he will not be jailed. So assuming he's indicted. So here's the backstory. Jesse Liu is the Trump-appointed United States attorney for the District of Columbia. When it was the Inspector General Horowitz, who was actually an appointee of Obama, but was so independent and so ethical that the Obama administration under Sally Yates stripped him of his ability to even investigate a wide range of matters, even though that was his duty under the law. So once Obama was out, Trump gave him, restored that power and authority to him. And it was Horowitz's report that said McCabe had committed multiple felonies while either being the deputy director or the actual director of the FBI.
Let's talk about some of those things they did.
Exactly. Oh, I mean, he was basically committing, he lied to them, so he obstructed justice. He misled them. He was leaking information illicitly in violation not only of internal FBI rules, but in violation of specific laws.
Lying to Congress.
Misleading Congress repeatedly. Misleading the President of the United States repeatedly. Purportedly involved in a plan to illicitly wiretap the president.
So he told the president, no one's ever spied on you, when he was directing it.
Exactly. Orchestrating it, organizing it, running it. This was the guy that was ahead of Peter Strzok. This was the guy that was ahead of all the key people doing all the illicit activity. Comey was the guy who was sort of the rubber stamp. McCabe was the actual orchestrator and organizer of all of it. So he also knows where all the bodies are buried, because remember, it was his wife who was running for office in Virginia.
That they gave $500,000 to.
Exactly. And who was it that helped orchestrate
Hillary.
That? Exactly, because it was the governor of Virginia that helped orchestrate that, who's been the longtime, I got a story about him, the longtime money man for the Clintons, going way, way back. There are deals involving him and high, powerful Democratic media supporters, how Clinton used him as a money man.
So that's why I said, I mean, this was a Clinton operative and yes. who ran all the illegal espionage. I mean, wow.
It was McCabe who shut down the email investigation in certain aspects of it, not Comey. It was McCabe who was directing key.
So this is a Clinton creature.
This is a guy who helped direct, who helped cancel the Clinton Foundation investigation. So, I mean, this guy is at the center of the cover-up of the Clinton corruption and the attempted coup against the President of the United States. And here's the backstory on this. Jesse Liu originally was slow playing this. So there was a lot of people that were upset that thought McCabe should have been indicted over a year ago, should have been indicted before the 2018 elections, which could have helped Trump win.
Well, what is this I was told about grand juries opening?
So there are potential grand juries, but the way the grand juries operate is they simply gather information. So there's what we call inside the business, we call a investigative grand jury and an indictment grand jury. And theoretically, constitutionally, every grand jury should just be an investigative grand jury, but it's not practically how it works, because prosecutors have carte blanche power in there. But what happens is an investigative grand jury just gets information. They're not looking to indict anyone. They're just looking, it's the tool by which the U.S. attorney can secretly get evidence about someone, secretly get subpoenas, so secretly have testimony, etc. And they usually scare witnesses into thinking that witnesses can't talk about what happened before the grand jury, when it's actually only the government and the grand jurors who can't talk about it. But that's why they like it. That's why they use it as a tool. But what happened here is a lot of people believe that Jesse Liu was slow playing it. And because he was slow playing it, they started getting increasingly agitated over the last several months. Also, somebody close to Trump leaked that he was originally considering giving a big promotion to Liu. And I talked about this a year and a half ago, that if she would indict McCabe, the president would probably put her number two or number three in the Department of Justice. She didn't. And so he let leak that he had originally planned on doing that. But given how she was slow playing these corruption investigations, he was having second thoughts. So it's not a surprise that suddenly she decided to accelerate the prosecution. And the language they use here isn't quite correct. What happens is certain kinds of cases, like tax cases, I do a lot of criminal tax cases, they have to be approved by the U.S. attorney for the tax division. The local U.S. attorney can't run those cases. Almost all cases, the local U.S. attorney, in this case Jesse Liu, could make her own determination. The other area where that's not true is high-profile political cases. Those have to be approved and authorized by the number two at the Department of Justice, the deputy attorney general.
That's why Rosenstein was such a key person to control all this.
So when Rosenstein was finally out, then that allowed, it looks like the number two currently, they have his name here. Yeah, because actually he talks about is Jeffrey Rosen, not Rosenstein. And so now all that happens is Liu decided she was going to recommend prosecution. That's the only reason why Rosen would be involved. That means Liu has already decided to prosecute him. But because,
so you're confirming from the way this is laid out that the decision to prosecute McCabe is here.
Exactly.
The Justice Department is going to prosecute the former acting head of the FBI a first. This is a big deal.
It's unprecedented.
And again, I'm not having a victory lap, but my endorphins are coming out. I'm having some pleasure right now because it feels like I'm getting these demons more off my back and all this hard work starting to pay off. Should I be feeling this good right now?
Absolutely. Everyone should feel good because this is the first time the sort of deep state has faced a threat since Mark Felt, former Deep Throat, was indicted for his COINTELPRO activities in the late 1970s. And then he got off the hook entirely. So here you have, while Trump is president, the leading orchestrator of deep state activities who has more intel and information about what was happening with Spygate, what was happening with Comey, what was happening with Brennan, what was happening with Clapper, what was happening with the Clinton Foundation, what was happening with the Clinton email investigation, then anyone in the entire government is now going to be indicted in the District of Columbia. He's going to face meaningful prosecution.
Please stay there. We got a break. Just the endorphin. Okay. Whoa. I don't have a lot of these because we were always fighting the enemy, but I'm having some, I'm getting high as a kite here. I hope you are. We're going to be right back. Hour number four. A few more segments. We'll get Matt Bracken's take on this as well, but hallelujah. Thank you, Jesus. This is great. Praise God and pass the information warfare ammunition. It's going to be rough now. They're going to go really crazy now. Let's talk about what you expect, how this will unfold in the next shoes to drop. Please, however you're watching. Countdown, ladies and gentlemen. Andrew McCabe. The decision has been made to indict him.
Exactly. The breaking news today is that U.S. Attorney Jesse Liu has chosen and decided already, has made the referral, and the referral has been approved and authorized to indict Andrew McCabe, the former director of the FBI, the former deputy director of the FBI, the key decision maker in the Clinton email case, the Clinton Foundation case, the orchestrator of the Spygate and coup attempts against the President of the United States, for his false statements to the FBI, for his false statements to the Office of Inspector General, for his illicit leaks to the media, for his attempts to illicitly spy on the President of the United States. All of that is going to be the basis and the reason and the predicate for an indictment, the first ever indictment against an acting director of the FBI who had ever been in any high-ranking position in the FBI. It's an extraordinary case where the first deep state indictment, really since Mark Felt in the late 1970s, who ran COINTELPRO and was known as Deep Throat, who secretly took out the Nixon administration. That's how significant and consequential this indictment is, because the way the process works is there's a doctrine called the delegation doctrine. It's a constitutional process about who has the approval and who has the authority to indict. While a grand jury has an indict, only a U.S. attorney can bring that case to the grand jury for the purposes of an indictment. And the way that works is the U.S., if it's a particular kind of case, tax case has to go to a particular U.S. attorney in charge of the tax division. If it's a certain kind of political case involving a high-ranking government official, then it has to be approved of by the deputy director, the deputy U.S. attorney, the number two in the United States Department of Justice, which is Jeffrey Rosen. Today it's reported that he has approved it. That means the indictment is coming within days, within weeks. Andrew McCabe will be indicted by the Department of Justice for his crimes against the President of the United States and on behalf of the Clinton family.
And against the voters of this country and our electoral system and our republic and this aura of invincibility, of infallibility of the Clinton crime machine and the Obama crime machine will then evaporate, and you'll start seeing many others turn state evidence very, very quickly. This is a giant moment for the Republic. This is approaching the level of when the British sued for peace 240 years ago. This is so massive, ladies and gentlemen, and you're going to see major counterstrikes, though. I suspect if they're ever going to try to kill Trump or ever try to stage a big terror attack or something, this is when the deep state is about to fire all barrels.
Well, in fact, I would say that this message is partially that, because apparently the source for this story coming out is McCabe himself. It's McCabe's legal team sending the message, by the way, I'm about to get targeted, I'm about to get hit. So it's a peculiar kind of timing. If I was McCabe's people, I wouldn't necessarily put this out to the public. Now, he did raise almost $700,000 for a legal defense fund and earlier, so maybe he's been planning on doing a fundraiser.
What about Arkansas? What about his family getting life insurance on him? I mean, I think this guy has as much longevity and a shelf life of Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, there's two things about McCabe. He has made clear to everybody for a long time that he'll rat out anybody and everybody to save his own hide. That's number one. Number two, he's the source of letting everybody know, hey, by the way, he's about to get indicted. So that's a very sort of peculiar thing to do if you want to protect yourself. The third aspect with him is that, if you're an insurance company, would you give life insurance right now to Andrew McCabe without some special exceptions for unusual and unexplained deaths?
Kayak accidents.
Yeah, you say, look, you know, we will insure
heart attacks. Slipping
in. It will insure you as long as your death can be fully and completely explained. But any unexplained death, sorry, no insurance for that. No sudden, weird ways of
car wrecks.
Yeah, no car wrecks. No weird way. No sudden unexplained heart
no
attack.
No falling downstairs.
Yeah, exactly. No, none of that. Committing suicide while you're temporarily in federal custody under a video camera. Nothing like that. So it will be interesting to see. Now, he does have intel and information literally on everybody. I mean, if you wanted to talk about a deep state hatchet man with all the information and intel, it is Andrew McCabe.
Covered up with the Clintons, the foundation, emails.
Ran the counter-espionage unit. So, I mean, you're talking about a guy who knows everything about Peter Strozik, knows everything about everybody and everyone.
And had access
and
to all the panopticonic big tech surveillance grids and everything else. Another stuffed suit. Another white shoe boy about to burn because he thought he could take down an elected president. He thought he could be a Chi-Com errand boy. You and the Chi-Coms are going to pay. America is rising. Stay with us.
I'll tell you, that Robert Barnes is very, very sharp. He's well thought of in civil rights circles. And he took on the Covington boys that were, you know, assaulted verbally and defamed possibly by these media. And I think recently Elizabeth Warren is trying to get out of that lawsuit and excuse herself using congressional, reasons and being a senator. But I don't know if that's going to do it. We got a little clip here next of Beto O'Rourke during the Thursday night debate talking about gun rights and what he would do. Here we go with that quote.
I do want to come to Congressman O'Rourke because I know this is personal to you. El Paso is your hometown. Some on this stage have suggested a voluntary buyback for guns in this country. You've gone further. You said, quote, Americans who own AR-15s and AK-47s will have to sell them to the government, all of them. You know the critics call this confiscation. Are you proposing taking away their guns, and how would this work?
I am. If it's a weapon that was designed to kill people on a battlefield, if the high-impact, high-velocity round, when it hits your body, shreds everything inside of your body because it was designed to do that so that you would bleed to death on a battlefield and not be able to get up and kill one of our soldiers. When we see that being used against children And in Odessa, I met the mother of a 15-year-old girl who was shot by an AR-15. Mm-hmm. And that mother watched her bleed to death over the course of an hour because so many other people were shot by that AR-15 in Odessa and Midland. There weren't enough ambulances to get to them in time. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
Beto O'Rourke doesn't understand what the Second Amendment is all about. I know it states in there about a well-regulated militia, but the British originally were going to confiscate our arms from us, the, you know, colonists. And so we rose up and said, no, we're not going to give you our arms because a disarmed population is a subservient slave population that can be subdued easily. A well-armed population, public, can stand up against tyrannies, and also it can act as a deterrent against an assault as a defensive mechanism. The Second Amendment is to protect us primarily from a tyrannical government out of control. That's really what it's about. A well-armed public is a deterrent to some degree of government that become out of control and move against subduing and suppressing their population. All these countries that were the Russians and the Chinese were dominant in, they had taken away the arms or not allowed arms to the public in their homes and so forth. They would allow sometimes in Russia to go hunting, but it was very regulated. But the right to keep and bear arms is, for example, Let's take a situation where a militia member is on his way to a well-regulated militia meeting. And let's just say someone jumps out of the shadows and tries to attack him, and he uses his gun, his pistol or rifle, to ward off that attack. Well, that's another reason why we should have the right to keep arms and defend ourselves. But also, he's on the way to that militia meeting. So what this is pointing out in my own analysis here, just to give our listening audience an idea, the Supreme Court has held this also and has backed up this. It's not only a collective right within the militia concept that the Constitution speaks about the Second Amendment, but it's an individual right also. And it's not about hunting. Many of the liberals on the left just always bring up this proposition about hunting. This is not about hunting. This is about really going and providing a mechanism, okay, to defend oneself, not only against criminals that might be, you know, home breaking you or home attacking your home or your family, protect your family, but it's also primarily to protect you and give you some deterrent against the rising government, a repressive, tyrannical government trying to subdue you and take away your property or make you do something against your will. So that's really what this is all about. And I just, you know, I try to reach out to the liberal left and try to get them to come up with some kind of an idea of the right to keep and bear arms is a right that we must continue to maintain in this country to maintain our very freedoms. We've got other things happening out there now today, and we have these continuing two representatives, Republicans, one in North Carolina just recently. So that voted well, and they spoke well for a possible return to control the House. Netanyahu is fighting for his political life in Israel. He's become a very much of a friend of President Trump. We've got a storm coming in. It's lashing. It's a tropical storm, and it's they see it possibly becoming a Dorian again. Boy, I hope not. And It's just one thing after another, isn't it? When you're first born into this world, the struggle begins. So it's not uncommon to get up every day, and the way that we do it, we go to our job, we try to provide a good service, a good benefit to our employer. If we're self-employed, we try to go out and try to treat people right and do work and do business, whether it's selling property like, you know, realtors do, or if it's providing a service, going out and fixing air conditioners, or, you know, like this hot summer that we have in Austin right now, or providing, you know, medical care if you're in the medical business. It's, you know, if you have doctors out here, they're providing good medical care to their patients, and hopefully we can move the doctors into integrated medicine. Yeah, a little less allopathic medicine, a little bit of naturopath type medicine. But also we need to continue these vitamins and the freedom and rights to use those vitamins to gain a wellness, you know, that we all need, you know, as we move and progress towards a eventual, you know, end of our lives, you know what I mean? Sullivan is saying, okay, Andrew Sullivan wrote an article recently in the Intelligencer, and he says that the New York Times has abandoned liberalism for activism. He says our democracy ideals were false when they were written. That's what the Times is beginning to come up with. These were ideas to destroy the country. And this is serious business. If these ideas about the founding fathers were racist and they didn't care about anyone else, and they've actually created these instruments to enslave people and continue their dominance. Well, let's come back with a little bit of a retort in this manner. Those very instruments have eventually benefited the poor and deprived and the minorities, because there were court rulings that found in their favor. There were lawsuits. There were other things that eventually resulted in the civil rights movement, a full restoration of rights that they should have had before, minorities or whatever. And so America is working. And it's working for the benefit of the common people. It's just that the cream de la cream on both sides, left and right, are using sort of a mind sorcery and money sorcery to continue. What really makes me mad sometimes is that these 10 horned generals will get up there and they'll write books on my leadership, how to lead people, you know, things like this. And then they'll not come clean on, say, 9/11. They're not coming clean on 9/11. And Charlotte Littlefield and I both, we believe that they ought to reinvestigate 9/11, open it back up, create a criminal case on it, you know. But these leadership people, like Hamza, they're claiming now, and Trump has just made, that they took out, you know, bin Laden's son, one of his sons, in an attack. But now, how about the attack in Pakistan? Was that a legitimate attack or not? We don't have a body of bin Laden. They threw it into the ocean. Well, what is that? What's the forensics on this? This is where they're practicing this mind sorcery on us, and we just continue to put up with it. We got fluoride streaming, coursing through our veins, and we're dumping, dumbed down in education, colleges and universities, and they're coming at us with destroying the Constitution as a living, breathing document, and then it can't lie, you know, die then. Well, I want to thank everyone for listening, in our listening audience out there, and we certainly care about this country, and Charlotte Littlefield Brown is one of the finest patriots you're going to run into. I want to thank everybody for listening out there. Thank you.